Whether you drive a car,
need a car,
or just occasionally bum a ride with friends,
you've come to the right place.
Join Jill and Tom as they break down everything that's going on in the auto world.
New car reviews,
shopping tips,
driving green,
electric cars,
classic cars,
and plenty of great guests.
This is the Consumer Guide Car Stuff Podcast.
All right, this is the Consumer Guide Car Stuff Podcast, and I am indeed Tom Appel, publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive. Thank you for joining us today. Hey, when you get a chance, do me a favor, do me a solid. Check us out at consumerguide.com. That's consumerguide.com. While you're there, check out our 2025 Best Buy picks. And remember that you can stream the podcast right there on our homepage. Plus, you want to go to the blog because that's where the fun stuff lives. All right, she's managing editor of Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk. She's a North American Car of the Year juror, and she's a prolific freelancer. And she's not here. Jill, that's her name, has left me high and dry. So I am flying solo today. Apologies if you get tired of my voice. But we do have a lot to cover. This is a big show, and a lot of stuff has happened since the last time we talked. So let's get to that first, and we'll get to this in a minute. There's an all-new RAV4 coming. I know there was a new Pope, but this is a bigger deal. The white smoke rose above Toyota's Achi plant in Tokyo, near Tokyo. That means new RAV4, big deal. A lot of news there, including an all-hybrid lineup, but we'll get to that in a minute. After the first break, we're going to talk to Alex Shelton. He is Portfolio Manager for Education and Future Work at Ford Philanthropy. Ford has given away some money, and they're giving it away to people who want to be automotive technicians. So you want to listen to this conversation. We'll learn more about Ford Philanthropy and how any budding want-to-be mechanics that you know might be able to score some money. So check that out. We'll get to that in a bit. So here's the deal. Tesla news, and there's always Tesla news, and there's always Cybertruck news, but the news this week is interesting. Tesla is now, in fact, accepting the Cybertruck in trade. So you can trade in your Cybertruck. That should help a little bit with resale value, though fabulously, Tesla is not paying a lot for those vehicles. So this will help a little, but maybe not a lot, but it has maybe freed up the market a little bit. But that's the story there. Here's an interesting story. Automotive News released a list that was put together by S&P Global Mobility, and it is a list of the manufacturers who sold the most EVs in March. Are you ready for this list? Still at the top of the list is Tesla. They sold 51,000 vehicles, almost exclusively Model Ys and Model 3s. As we know, the Cybertruck isn't selling. And the old school Model Model S and Model X, those vehicles, they're on the way out. They stopped selling them in China. They stopped selling them in some other markets. They said those are the only vehicles that they build. Or I'm sorry, they build those only in the Fremont, California factory. And I think those are going away to make room for other stuff. So there's that. But here's the surprise player. And I think people will be surprised by this. Big news, Chevrolet is now the number two manufacturer and seller of EVs in the United States. They sold about 9,000 vehicles. That's up 300% from a year ago. And they've got a lot of stuff they're selling. There's the Equinox EV, which can be done for less than $30,000, theoretically, with the federal tax credit. There's the Blazer EV, that is a larger vehicle, but mechanically very similar. And the Silverado EV is out there as well. For some reason, Ford is down in March. That's interesting. 7,000 units, down about 13% from the year before. The Mustang Mach-E, which used to sell, it's been variable, but a very competent, very likable, very sporty-looking crossover, little EV crossover, not doing the business it used to be. Ford is selling a lot of its e-transits. That's its large van in electric form. And the F-150 Lightning is still out there. Number four, no big surprises. Hyundai, still there. Sales up slightly from the year before. The IONIQ 5 and IONIQ 6 are a big deal. The IONIQ 9, which is a large three-row crossover coming online as we speak. Here's an interesting one. They've been quietly selling pretty well, and their sales keep getting better. BMW. BMW is selling a fair number of EVs in the U.S. They sold 5,500 in March. That's up 32,000 from the year before. And I recently drove the i5, which is an EV version of a vehicle roughly the size of the 5 Series, a delightful car. Little expensive, came to close to $80,000, but really a likable EV, very simple car. The whole EV part of it was really a non, a non-issue except for having to plug it in. I like that car a lot. After that, Rivian. Rivian's having a hard time getting rolling here in the United States, and it was a few episodes ago that I suggested that now that they have this huge cash infusion from Volkswagen, because Volkswagen is buying into Rivian so that they can use their electronic architecture, it seemed like Rivian was on easy street, but they're still having a hard time selling the product, and it seems like they're having a hard time making money on the product they're selling. The stuff itself may not be profitable, but the 1ST and the 1RT, that is a midsize crossover and a midsize pickup truck, very good-looking vehicles, very well-reviewed, little pricey. They tend to run about $80,000, $90,000. For whatever reason, not gaining traction with the public. Their sales aren't increasing. So, weird story there. Number 7 is a strange story. I don't think people saw this coming, but Cadillac now on the list. Cadillac sold about 3,400 EVs in March. That's up 86% from a year before. But here's the weird thing about Cadillac. If you were paying attention, Cadillac's wiping out most of its gasoline-powered vehicles. So the CT4 and CT5, that's a compact and midsize gasoline-powered sedans, those are going away, though they're supposed to come back in some other form. But the XT4, which was a volume car for the brand, right? A nice car, I've driven it. XT4, compact crossover. I've got a buddy that owns one, he loves it. Discontinued. Interesting, but here's the thing. For 2026, Cadillac's going to have 5 different EVs for sale, which will make them, I think, the most prolific EV seller in the U.S. So there's the Lyriq, midsize crossover, the Vistiq, which is a midsize crossover with 3 rows, the Optiq, which is a compact, more or less the size of the XT4, the crazy over-the-top $400,000 Celestiq, and then 2 versions of the Escalade IQ and Escalade IQL, the L is for long, so that's the long wheelbase version of that vehicle. Mercedes-Benz is number 8 on the list with about 3,000 vehicles sold in March. The Mercedes has had a little issue. Their sales are actually down 22% from a year before. And the problem here is price, where BMW has come in at lower price levels with its EVs. Mercedes came in at the high end with electric versions of its S-Class products and its E-Class products. Jill is actually in one of these now. I think she said she was driving the EQE, which is the electric midsize sedan, so she'll have something to talk about soon. All right, Honda rounds out the list at number 9. This one's interesting because Honda just sells one electric vehicle in the U.S., and actually General Motors builds it for them, but it seems like the world was ready, or at least Americans were ready, for an electric Honda. So the Prologue, supposedly a really great car. I haven't driven it myself. I think Jill has driven it, and I think she liked it. It's based on General Motors' BEV3 architecture, which is the same as you would find in the Equinox EV or the Blazer EV. But, yeah, that's doing well for them. And then finally, Kia. Kia, of course, mechanically similar products to Hyundai. They're further down the list, but their EV6, very popular. And their new EV9, which is a large 3-row crossover, very cool. I just want to talk about something here interesting, just because we're not going to get these cars. But we talked about the GM's BEV architecture. We talked about the Prologue and the Equinox and the Blazer. In China, Buick sells a pair of electric vehicles that we don't get, the Electra 4 and the Electra 5. These are midsize crossovers. They look good looking. I couldn't find out too much about them, strangely, and I don't read Chinese. But we're supposed to be getting Electra versions of these vehicles as well in the U.S., but the timelines have all been pushed back. In fact, speaking of those timelines, we'll be talking about these soon. But if you've been paying attention, Ram, the builder of the Ram 1500 pickup, very nice pickup truck, was working on an electric vehicle that has been pushed back twice now, and it looks like the soonest that we will see a pure electric Ram is 2027. So that got pushed back, and the long-range version of it, that would be the version that would be more expensive with the larger battery, has been apparently, reportedly, axed, so we will never see that vehicle. And then there's the Ram Charger, which was the plug-in hybrid of the vehicle that was technically pulled ahead a while back, is now also being pushed back. So we may not see that next year either. But for people who don't know, this was a Ram pickup truck with a huge range for a plug-in hybrid of about 130 miles and also powered by a 3.6-liter V6 that would only drive the motor. So that vehicle also, bummer, pushed back. So that's what's going on in the electric world. we talked a little bit about this before, and I want to get to it now. There's a brand new RAV4. And like I said, this is like a new Pope. This is a huge deal. And this is a vehicle that Toyota makes so much of its money on here in the U.S. But last year, I'm sure I have notes on this someplace. Yes, I do. Last year, Toyota sold 475,000 RAV4s, making it easily the best-selling non-pickup truck in the U.S. For comparison purposes, the CR-V, Honda's likable CR-V, about 400,000 units, which is a huge number, too. In third place, and it's way down the list, is the Nissan Rogue at 271,000. That is a nice vehicle, and we'll get back to that in a moment. The Hyundai Tucson at 183,000, and then finally the Forester at 170. That's the Subaru Forester. Very nice vehicle, just redesigned. And that's a big number for Subaru. Subaru is not the big retailer that these other makers are. So, Hose, here's the deal. If you're thinking about a midsize crossover, you might wait until you see the Toyota RAV4. It is new for 2026, and it's completely new. First redesign, I think, since 2018. It is approximately the same size, which is good because I'm tired of seeing things get bigger. The big news, and I think it's the big news, this vehicle is hybrid only for 2026. So here are your options, regular hybrid or plug-in hybrid. Now, we know the plug-in hybrid is going to be a lot more money, so most people are going to be opting for the base plug-in hybrid. And another piece of good news, last year when there was still a regular gasoline version of the vehicle available, you could not get the hybrid with front-wheel drive. Now you can. That's good for two reasons. If you don't need the snow capability, you will get better mileage and you will pay less for the vehicle. Although people should understand when they opt for front-wheel drive on vehicles available with all-wheel drive, you might see a small ding on resale value later on. Probably not enough to matter. So here's a weird thing, and I'm not entirely sure why Toyota is doing this, but they are now categorizing their trim levels into three groups: core, rugged, and sport. Sounds exciting. Those are not trim levels. Those are trim level categories. And I think that if a manufacturer has to tell you the trim level categories, there are entirely too many categories or too many trim levels. But here's what's going on. Core, and these vehicles should look more or less like a regular RAV4. There will be an LE model, that's the base model, an XLE, and then a top line limited. Rugged gets a new name. That is the Woodland now. And you can think of it like all the other kind of woodsy vehicles that are being introduced these days, like the Subaru Wilderness. But the Woodland will come with a slightly elevated ride height, different wheels and tires, and very aggressive kind of SUV-looking exterior trim. So that's that story. And then the sport category gets interesting in a moment. So there's an SE and an XSE, and these will look sportier, but they won't be sportier. But there is now a GR Sport that is actually legitimately sporty. It's going to get a sport suspension. It's going to get specific wheels and tires, a sport interior, and it should ride and handle very differently than the other vehicles. Also, and this is interesting, comes only with the plug-in hybrid drivetrain. The reason for that is the plug-in hybrid drivetrain, much more power than the other vehicles. The all-wheel drive version of the hybrid is 236 horsepower. The plug-in hybrid, 320. So that's a big jump. The GR Sport, of course, they're using the GR, which stands for Gazoo Racing, which means nothing to Americans. But Toyota likes the brand. And that's a racing series, a number of racing initiatives that are headed by Toyota, Gazoo Racing. So we just talked about the GR Corolla earlier on the show, a couple episodes ago. So that's that story. Here's another bit of part about this, and this one kind of matters, and it's kind of interesting, and it kind of makes the plug-in hybrid more interesting. And that is the fact that the plug-in hybrid is now available with DC fast charging. And I think we've talked about charging before. There's home charging where you just plug in a garage. That's 110. That's called level one. Or you buy a charger at your house. That's 220 volt. You need someone to professionally install that. That's called level two. And that's pretty quick, but not super quick. But it will charge a car fully overnight if it's a full EV. Generally, you don't see fast charging for plug-in hybrids. In fact, I haven't seen it before, at least not that I'm aware of. But now you can plug in at a level three. This is a public charger, something like Electrify America or EVgo. You can plug in there with these vehicles. So they are now compatible with fast charging. It's not that fast. However, given that it only gets 50 miles of range anyway, it will take your vehicle from 10% charge to 80% charge in about half an hour. Another interesting thing here about the RAV4 and Toyota in general is that a lot of noise has been made recently in the media about how the public seems to be clamoring for hybrids. And while that seems to be basically true, and hybrid ownership experience is basically painless. You just pay more up front, and then your vehicle just gets you better mileage. There isn't a lot there to do, unless the hybrid drivetrain itself isn't very good. That's not the case with Toyotas. Toyotas have excellent hybrids. Toyota keeps converting its regular products to hybrid only. So now the Camry, the Sienna, the RAV4, the Crown, those vehicles are hybrid only. And you may remember the Venza, which is kind of a luxury version of the RAV4. That was hybrid only too. And the net effect is that you have this huge volume of cars. I mean, these four vehicles here line up to be 700,000 or 800,000 units. That's a big chunk of the U.S. industry by themselves. And now they are hybrid only. So my question is, are people clamoring for hybrids, or are hybrids simply more available now? There's another thing going on here with this, and it's being presented to the public as if it matters to the public, and I don't think it does. But if you've heard anything about software-defined vehicles, we're getting closer and closer to this, and what a software-defined vehicle is a vehicle in which all the systems on the vehicle, and this is infotainment, interior comfort, HVAC, and the parts of the car that are involved in making it actually move, would all be controlled simply and singularly by a single piece of software. And the reason you want to do this is for easy over-the-air updates, for connectivity purposes, and eventually for self-driving vehicles. We're a long way from all this stuff, but you do find that manufacturers are working on the software now because this software is very difficult to develop. And we have talked about the fact that Volkswagen has had its difficulties developing EV architecture software, and that is actually why they partnered with Rivian. But nonetheless, here's the story. Toyota has developed something they call Arene, A-R-E-N-E, Arene. And it is its software-defined vehicle software, and it is being first applied in the RAV4. Here's the deal. I don't think this matters to anyone who drives the vehicle. They're branding it. They want to get ahead. I'm sure shareholders like to hear that they're technically advanced. This should not affect the ownership experience at all. That said, the interior of the RAV4 does include new larger touchscreens and new software that's supposed to work more quickly. I've never had any problems with Toyota infotainment systems or the connectivity situated there anyway. A piece of bad news, and I've already seen people complain about this, interior HVAC controls, climate controls, used to be all this really uncomplicated, simple physical switch gear, a knob, a switch, something like that. A lot of that has been moved to the touchscreen. We'll see how that goes. I remember complaining loudly when Toyota removed volume controls from some of its products, which came back. Now, what I mean by volume controls is the console knob that we all love and respect, and they had moved that to a steering wheel switch, which no one gets used to. Well, some people do. I guess I do. All right. That is the story. We have a new RAV4, which is really cool. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk to Alex Shelton with Ford Philanthropy. Stick around.
Questions or comments?
Drop us a line at carstuff@consumerguide.com.
That's carstuff@consumerguide.com. Welcome back to the Car Stuff Podcast.
And we're back. This is the Consumer Guide Car Stuff Podcast. Thanks for sticking around today. This is a time of the show where I usually have Jill remind me to talk about my social media endeavors. However, Jill is out today. So I would just tell you that I'm Car Guy Tom. Car Guy Tom on Twitter, X, and Blue Sky. Do check that out. All right. On the phone with me today is Alex Shelton. He is the Portfolio Manager for Education and Future Work at Ford Philanthropy. Alex, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on today.
Oh, thanks for joining us. And I know we messed with your schedule a little bit, and we really appreciate you accommodating us. Alex, tell us about Ford Philanthropy and what you do there.
Yeah, Ford Philanthropy, we are the philanthropic arm of Ford Motor Company. And so we invest in communities around the globe where Ford lives and operates. And we, Ford Philanthropy, supports a variety of programs that help people move forward and upward. I sit on our education team. So our team is looking at how do we support students to obtain the skills and create pathways that are necessary to employment in the mobility industry. And so I'm excited to talk about one of those programs today, which is our AutoTech Scholarship Program.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to talking about this. Real quick, tell us a little bit about Ford Philanthropy, though. How is that funded? Is that entirely funded from the revenues generated by Ford Motor Company? Or do people donate that to that? And like, what kind of business do you guys do annually?
Yeah, that's correct. It is all coming from Ford Motor Company.
Okay.
And so within our communities, we support everything from brick and mortar community centers. We support disaster relief efforts. We support scholarship programs and educational workforce development programs. We support mobility solutions and access to food security. So we do quite a bit that focuses on education and essential services with how do we use our unique differentiator of mobility to create impact and solutions for our communities.
Well, that's really cool. How are decisions made as to who receives revenue or funds or support from Ford Philanthropy?
Yeah, you know, we are typically funding around wherever Ford has a presence at. And so when we talk to the nonprofit partners, we evaluate, does it fit into our strategy of where we're trying to make impact at? And so, as I mentioned, that's education and essential services. And so we look for nonprofits across the world who are leaning into those areas. Sometimes nonprofits reach out. Sometimes we reach out to them. But really, it's an exploratory process to look at who's doing some amazing work and how can Ford come behind those organizations, not just with dollars, but using the whole kind of brand of Ford. How do we use Ford employees, the volunteers, do skill-based volunteering where employees can flex their own muscles of as engineers or as designers or as accountants to support in their communities? But also then how do we kind of put some of the innovation and ideas of Ford into practice as well? And so we really think it's more than just a financial commitment. We want to be partners in our communities.
Great. All right. So I was checking out your website today, and one of the things I read, I think I read this on your website or I found this someplace else, but it's probably basically accurate. By 2028, the United States will have a shortage of auto mechanics that numbers 471,000 technicians. That's a crazy number. How do we know that number?
Yeah, we work with our nonprofit Tech Force Foundation, who runs our scholarship program. They also do a lot of research and some really awesome supply and demand reports for technicians as a whole, not just auto, but diesel, collision, aviation. And so they have some pretty good reports that go through the supply and demand of technicians. And to your point, that automotive number that's going to be needed in the next few years is $471,000 techs is what they're estimating the industry needing.
So you guys have been into this for a little bit of while, offering scholarships, and we'll talk about what those scholarships mean in a moment. But you gave away about $1 million in 2023, $2 million last year, and you guys are upping that ante to $4 million this year. Why the increase in interest in getting people into the tech business?
Yeah, you know, we're so excited to be now in year three. I almost said launching, but we're launched, right? We're almost 3 months in, and it's a program between Ford Philanthropy and our Ford dealers, and so we co-fund this program together. And why we do this is a few reasons. Is one, we recognize there is a shortage that doesn't just impact Ford; it impacts all of the automotive industry as a whole. We see this as a value to help students get to school with the money, help them get through school with scholarships and internships and part-time work, and then get into their careers by offering job placements. And so we see this as a way to really impact students in that regard. We see this as a way to impact perception and look at how do we help change the narrative about what it means to be an auto technician. What is this career path? And I'm sure we'll talk more about that, but we're really excited to talk about how this is high tech. This can be high paying. This can be a very future-proof career, and we're very proud to share that narrative as well. So dealers are excited, Ford's excited, which has led to the continued growth year over year.
I like the term future-proof. When I was in high school in the 80s, I did work for a while turning wrenches at a service station, if people remember what a service station was. but it was not a glamorous job at the time. I think there was some respect for the people who had the technical acumen to do that stuff, but it was hard work. I worked at a place that was not air-conditioned or heated, at least not well-heated, and it's the kind of job that you would get tired of over the years. It It was dirty, grueling work, and that is no longer the case at all, right? It is really much more of a diagnostic position now. You still need that mechanical acumen, but there's so much more to it.
Yeah, I was just talking with someone on our technology team the other day, and he was sharing how the diagnostics are changing rapidly and how that's going to impact technicians and how technicians are ordering parts and how that whole side of the business is changing. It's rapid. And it is a completely different skill set. You still need to understand the vehicle, but it's a different skill set. And then we had another student who she got interviewed on Fox News a while back, a few months ago. And she was asked, well, if it's all just electrical, can't you just pop out one chip and plug a new chip in and you're good? And she smiles, and this technician who she received a scholarship, she starts to giggle and she says, you know, it can be that easy. But she goes, these wires are connected, and you have modules and wires that are connected on one side of the vehicle that impacts a completely different thing on the other side of the vehicle. So you're having to trace wires and understand schematics to be able to say, no, the reason why this isn't working on the radio is because of this wire back here. She goes, it is so incredibly complex. And so it is a completely different role, but it is so technologically filled. And I think you're exactly right in that, especially with the diagnostics.
So here's the thing that I understand, and we recently had, not recently, a couple of years ago, we had a guest from a local technical institute on the podcast, and the institute, the school, is very well regarded. However, it is pricey. And I think the program, I think it was about 2 years, something like that, but it was very expensive to get through, and it was difficult for students, because not only did they have to pay for this education, at some point they have to pay for their tools too. So to launch into this business, to launch into this trade, you do need some money up front or some support. And I guess that's what you guys are trying to help with here, right?
Exactly. And so the way this is branded as, it's a cost of attendance scholarship. What that means, It goes to the university to be applied to tuition, but if tuition is already paid for by other scholarships or by your financial aid or by a state program, then once the tuition is paid, that money then can roll into the student's account to be used for anything that's a barrier for education. We hear a lot of auto technicians tell us it's tools. We also have a lot of auto techs that say it's transportation. I can't get to and from.
A simple thing like that.
I have a car, but I have a flat tire. I know how to change my tire. I can't afford the tire. And so students are able to use some of these extra funds that roll into their account for anything, whether that's transportation concerns, childcare, rent, groceries. We recognize that there are so many barriers that can stop an individual from pursuing and completing their education. And we want to be as flexible as we can with our funding that allows it to meet whatever need it is that the student has.
Alex, you said something interesting, and that was childcare, and I hadn't considered that. But are a lot of people who are starting to work as automotive technicians? I thought they'd kind of be start of career style techs, but there are people midlife maybe just switching over or earning new skills.
Yeah, I love that you're asking that question, because that has been something that has been so cool to see. Over the last couple of years, it's starting to get that data about who is receiving our scholarships. And so from the 2024 program, we had students who were out of high school and receiving the scholarship, but we also had an individual who was over 60.
Wow.
We had 40 individuals between 30 and 39, 16 between 40 and 49. And so there are these large kind of tranches of people who are, to your point, they're upskilling, they're reskilling, they're changing careers.
That's great.
I went in and I talked to one student at a school, and he said, I was a teacher, but I wanted a career change. I love vehicles. I love the thought of the new technology and the way to use my hands, but also my brain, and blend that together. So he's like, I'm back in school right now and looking to become an auto technician. And he's like, I see the value in it. And so it is every aspect of student. We do see a ton of students who are in their first career, but all across the age spectrum, we have students receiving scholarships.
Cool. So we should talk a little bit about the money and the scholarship itself in a moment, but tell us who qualifies for this and what aptitude you think you're looking for in the kind of person who should consider this job or a career in this field, I should say.
Yeah, I'll start with the first part. That's pretty easy. Is who's eligible? If you go to techforce.org, ford.com/Ford Philanthropy.
Okay.
We have a who's eligible section on there. And I take you there because you have to be enrolled in the automotive program at an eligible school. And so there are certain regions across the country that are eligible. It does cover, I think we have schools in, I believe, 45 different states. But you can see on that list if you're eligible. And then from there, it's a needs-based scholarship. And so that's based off of FAFSA. And so you have to complete your FAFSA, and you have to go to an eligible school enrolled in an auto or auto diesel program. And that's it. That is the requirement. And then from there, you fill out an application, and it's reviewed by our partner Tech Force, and then they make selections on a monthly basis.
So, Alex, you're looking for people who are already in programs. This is to help them make sure that they complete the program.
Or a student who's looking to enroll in a program.
Oh, okay. I misheard you. My bad. Okay. That sounds good. And then...
I could have missaid that.
And then how long before they hear back, and what kind of money are we talking about?
Yeah. So students are hearing back on a monthly basis about their scholarships. So students are applying and receiving scholarships every month, and that's one of the beauties of it. It is a first-come, first-served program. And so we've already awarded some scholarship recipients, and we'll continue to do that until the funds are exhausted in each region. But then to the other question you asked about, like, who are we looking for, and what does career growth look like? Well, you know, it's interesting because you have so many different people who are choosing this career path. You have those who they grew up in a shop with maybe their mom or dad or grandma or grandpa, aunt or uncle, somebody who was showing them how to work on vehicles. And there's a lot of individuals coming up that path. There's a lot of others who said, like, I love racing. I just watched the Drive to Survive series on Netflix, and I'm super interested in racing and what an auto technician career could look like. Or I love the electronics piece. Like, I took some electronics courses in high school, and now I want to know, like, how do I become an EV technician? And so there's people coming from all backgrounds, but really we're looking at, are you wanting to learn and show up and be curious? You're coming to a career path where you can earn six figures as an auto technician, a career path where you can write your own story, where you can say, you know what, I want to grow and get my certs and become a master tech and a senior master tech, or maybe become a service advisor, or maybe go into the sales side, or maybe I want to go work for an OEM down the road, right? You're kind of able to create your own journey. This auto technician pathway is the starting spot. And so we have individuals from all sorts of backgrounds, but really it's the blending of that hands-on work, that technical capacity and curiosity, in this dynamic, changing industry.
It's cool for me to hear the term automotive tech or mechanic in the same words as career path, because I think that when I was younger and possibly considering becoming a mechanic, and I would have been a lousy mechanic, I just want to make that clear. but when I was turning wrenches, there wasn't really a career there exactly. It was just a job that you would do for 20 or 30 years. And now you're using the term career and career path, and I think that's very exciting. Is it realistic that someone who becomes a tech, goes to a dealership, starts working there, works there for 5 or 6 years, has this experience under their belt, they can do other things? Is service writer a thing they can do? Is manager a thing they can do? Like, how does that work? How is this different now than it was 30 years ago?
Oh, I wish I had people here with me to share their stories. The stories I've heard that I'm going to share are, there's people I work with at Ford who were technicians and then became what we're calling field service engineers, and people who were techs and are now working, overseeing our Ford technical training programs. There's people who have been technicians and became engineers, or people who were technicians at a dealership who are now owning their own shops, people who are now dealer principals. There's people who...
One dealer principals, wow.
Yeah, I met a dealer last year at an event who owns his own dealership now, started as a technician. And so you hear all these stories, and what we're really excited about is, again, students love to race. And we just got to take five of our scholarship recipients to Dallas Motor Speedway a couple weeks ago for the NASCAR race.
Fun.
And we got to take the students behind the scenes and meet a driver and see some haulers and go through the garage and get on pit lane and then end up on Victory Circle getting a picture of Joey Logano. And for those students, they're like, whoa, I just got to see what it actually takes to become a NASCAR technician or a NASCAR engineer or a crew chief. And so they're even looking at all the other pathways completely outside of here. So I know I went on a long ramble there, but there's so many ways that you can grow from this is your starting spot and your springboard into a really exciting career.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned field service technicians, for example, and engineers. Is there a shortage of them as well, at least those that are being fed through the technician channel?
You know, I don't have any data with me now about whether there is there or not. But I do know that when I talk to individuals in that role, those who have the technical experience of working in a shop and understanding that side of the house, they're better at their jobs now because they've lived that experience. And so I can't speak to whether there's a shortage or not, but mm-hmm. I can definitely speak to being a value add from having the technician experience beforehand.
Now, you had mentioned the success stories, and that's exciting. What about job satisfaction? What do you hear from techs who are there now in the business? Do they like their jobs? Are they happy? Are they glad they made these moves?
Yeah, you know, I have one story, and I'm speaking in stories. I don't have raw data in front of me. And I also think the stories resonate well with people. But there's a young woman who I interviewed her and her mom, actually, and asked, like, how did you feel when your daughter decided to become a technician? How did you feel when she got the scholarship? How do you feel now that she has a full-time job? And the mom was very honest of, like, she's the first one who didn't go to school for this, like, professional, I guess you could say, job, right? She, like, sure. Her family were doctors and lawyers and accountants, and she's like, I want to go be a technician. Her parents are like, well, what are you doing? And then she got to school, and she gave up a scholarship to play soccer, and she went to school, to a technical school, to get this degree, and then she was loving it, and then she was going home and talking about it, and then she told her mom she got a scholarship, and then the mom started listening more and watching more, and the mom's like, I just saw her so excited for what she was doing and so in love with what she was doing. And that young woman is she went to school out of state, and she didn't go home. She is still working and growing, and her boss owns another shop and pulled her over to the other shop as well to grow and have more experience there. And so that's the one anecdotal story I have of, like, seeing a mom and a family come behind a student when they were completely unaware of what this industry meant.
So, Alex, we're almost out of time, and I really appreciate you joining us today. But long term, 15, 20 years out, do you anticipate the demand for auto technicians maintaining at this level, staying high, or are we worried about something like AI taking over?
You know, that's one of the beauties that we talk about in this is, like, we've been calling it kind of a future-proof career choice that
right.
blends your hands-on skills alongside cutting-edge technology, because AI is going to be used, right? And there's tools that are going to be used, and technology that's going to be in place. But we need people still. And that is something about this job, that there are still people that are needed. And, you know, I just even heard about some technology today that's able to scan and diagnose cars just by sitting on this scanner. It's kind of this new cutting-edge technology that's being explored. People still need to repair the vehicle.
Yeah.
And we're not to the point yet where that's able to happen through AI. And so we think this is very much a career that is kind of future-proof and offers a ton of stability, because guess what? You're living in Michigan now. I'm in Detroit, but I want to move over to Chicago with you, right? Like, you need technicians there as well. And so
yep.
there's jobs wherever you go. And so that's another, I think, exciting piece for students, is that they know that they're able to find careers even as they're maybe bouncing between states or bouncing between locations.
Cool. Alex, remind us real quick, how can people learn more about the scholarship and how can people apply?
Yes, you can learn more about this $4 million scholarship fund at techforce.org/Ford Philanthropy. Techforce.org/Ford Philanthropy. You can apply for the scholarship. Again, we're giving out 800 scholarships at $5,000 a piece. We really want to help students get to school, through school, and see them into their automotive careers.
Super cool. We will link to that address on our Facebook page. Alex, thank you so much for your time today.
Tom, I appreciate you having me on. This is a fun conversation.
All right. That was Alex Shelton. He is the Portfolio Manager for Education and Future Work at Ford Philanthropy. We're going to take a break, and then I have a quiz surprise for you. Stick around.
Questions or comments?
Drop us a line at carstuff@consumerguide.com.
That's carstuff@consumerguide.com. Welcome back to the Car Stuff Podcast.
And we're back. This is the Consumer Guide Car Stuff Podcast. I'm Tom, flying solo today. This is the part of the show where Jill usually goes on endlessly about social media. Just make sure you follow her at jillsimonillo@myspace.com. But I believe the thing she wants you to know is at Jill Simonillo. which you need to learn to spell. All right, I've got no one here for the quiz, so I have turned to producer Randy. You've heard him a couple times before, but never at length. Randy, how are you today?
I'm good. How are you doing, Tom?
I am good. Here's the thing. I got a quiz in front of me. I wrote this. It took me hours to write this quiz.
I'm sure.
I jotted this off this morning. But you have owned a Pontiac Fiero.
I bought a brand new Pontiac Fiero, ordered it from the factory, first model year 1984.
Wow.
So, yes, I am ancient.
The thing about, I think we're about the same age or close. You might be a little younger than me, but the thing about the Fiero that was so interesting, and we talked about this just a couple of shows ago, it was startling when it came out.
Oh, yeah.
It was plastic. It was two-seat. It was small. It was rakish. Everything about it was kind of cool. And if you didn't dig too deep into the technology, even the tech was cool. It was mid-engine.
Yeah. Yeah, the mid-engine thing there was no other mid-engine American car, right?
No.
As far as I know.
They handled pretty well, and over time, they came to handle better.
Yeah.
But that was the deal. And it was ill-fated for a bunch of reasons. The two-seat thing didn't play that well. There were some quality control issues early on. And by the time that they made some important improvements to the car, no one cared anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
And the marketing money wasn't there. So today's quiz, producer Randy, is Fiero! Exclamation point.
Okay.
I've got five questions for you, all about the Fiero, plus a bonus question. Today's bonus question is a startler, and I'll tell you why when we get to it.
All right.
You need three total for a win.
Okay.
This is your first quiz. It could be your first quiz win.
Or my last.
That's true. That's true. All right. Are you ready, sir?
I'm ready.
Number one, 1984 Fiero. Was the base price, the base price, $79.95 or $99.95?
Well, knowing what I paid for mine, which had a lot of options on it, I paid about around $13.5 for mine.
Oh, wow.
So I think I had virtually everything on the car. I'm going to say $99.95.
No, it was strangely $79.95.
Was it really?
Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about some base stuff in a moment. But yeah, it started super cheap, and I think that was part of the campaign.
That surprises me that it's that low, as much as I paid.
Yeah, because In 84, I purchased a Pontiac Sunbird, and that one came to $81.88 out the door, on the door. That was a much less interesting car. That car, people might remember this. These cars are all gone now, and they've rusted, and God bless them. They used to have little stickers on the side, little badges on the side of the better-equipped Sunbirds, the Pontiac Sunbirds, that said OHCFI, OHC/FI. Overhead cam fuel injection.
Wow.
And this was an engine that was imported from Brazil, so it was exotic.
Very exciting.
That engine sucked. It was so coarse and crude. The opposite of those small Honda and Volkswagen engines. All right, you have no points, sir. Number two, at launch, the 1984 Fiero, what two colors were offered? Was it bright red and white, bright red and yellow, bright red and midnight blue? I said that like there's a fourth, but
that would be red and white.
Yes, it was. Red
Mine
and white.
Was red.
They were all red.
Yeah, yeah, that was the color for sure.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, you know, there's an old saying among Corvette owners, at least among people I know, all Corvettes are red, the rest are mistakes. And Fiero, to me, kind of is the same thing.
Yeah.
All Fieros are red.
That's what looked great in red. And I remember all the advertising vehicles were red.
Yeah.
Later on in 84, they added silver, metallic, and black. And I don't remember silver ones at all, but I absolutely remember black ones.
Yeah, they didn't make as... I think silver was probably the least popular color, but I saw a few of those.
All right.
And then they brought yellow along in later years.
I remember the yellow.
Yeah.
I remember the yellow. It looked pretty good.
Yeah.
That's the kind of car that should be yellow. Not should be, but works in yellow. All right. What were the standard wheels on the 79.95 Fiero, were they 13-inch or 14-inch?
Oh, man. I would say 13.
They were.
Yeah. Yeah.
They were 13-inch.
Like bicycle tires. Yeah.
Yeah. 185 80-13s. That number doesn't mean anything to most people, but skinny. That means skinny. They were skinny little tires. The optional tire, which you probably got, was 215 60-14. Those had to look good and chunky.
Yeah. Yeah. They were chunky. Yeah.
That looks good. All right, you have 2 points, sir. This is going good.
We'll see.
Well,
you're taxing my memory from 41 years ago.
Well, this one you wouldn't have even known then, I don't think. This is just a dumb question. Producer Randy, what was the approximate base curb weight of a 1984 Fiero? Was it 2,000 pounds or 2,500 pounds?
Hmm. I'm going to say 2,500.
It was.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had an 84 Scirocco, which was a car that was engineered to be light. Or 85. I'm sorry, 85. And that was 2,100 pounds then.
I mean, that was one of the great things about the Fiero is it wasn't, it didn't have that much horsepower, but it was a fairly lightweight car. So it was kind of nimble feeling, even though it didn't have a lot of oomph to it.
Did you have the four-speed manual?
Yeah. Yeah.
My cousin bought a Fiero used, but right there, like 85 or something like that. It was red and nicely equipped, but he let me drive it. So it's just the 2.5 liter four-cylinder engine.
Yep.
But appropriately geared, I guess. But yeah. It felt quick around town.
It did, yeah. And that stick was actually kind of fun.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of a nice car. All right, speaking of engines, and I almost said it by accident. I didn't want to do that. Randy, what was the nickname for the base engine? The General Motors internal nickname for the engine. Was it the Iron Duke or the Fireball 4?
I think it was Iron Duke.
It was. Yeah. Fireball would have been ironic.
I'll tell you two quick stories about that car that in 30 seconds. One was after I had the car about a year, I hit a deer with it.
Oh,
which
no.
Which in a little low-slung sports car like that is kind of horrifying. The second story is there was a recall on the 84s and maybe even 85 on the engines because they were detonating and basically cracking pistons. And
I don't remember that.
Really?
Also, internal engine problems.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I went to the dealer where I bought it. They said, well, we don't have the parts, so come back. I waited. And in the meantime, as I was waiting, boom, I was out one night sitting by the side of the interstate with smoke coming out of the back of the car. I fought with General Motors for 3 months probably to get them to actually cover it because I had good faith tried to get them to do the recall and they couldn't. Eventually they did, but it was a big hassle.
So what was, I remember underhood fires.
Yeah, which I don't know if that was related to my problem or not, but mine was an actual recall.
It might have been.
Yeah.
If I'm thinking, I'm trying to think, because that engine, the Iron Duke, was in everything.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a great engine, but one of the things it was reasonably reliable.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, was there like a cooling problem?
Boy, this was 41 years ago. I think there was a coolant leak that would leak into the piston and cause it to crack.
Oh.
I think. I'd have to look into that again. It's been a long time.
See, that's General Motors does these things,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
That car should have been cool. And it kind of was cool. But the same thing happened with the 1980 Citation and all the other X cars, if people remember those. They were radical. They were front-wheel drive. They were transverse engine, extremely space efficient, really nice cabins, great ride and handling. And they liked to catch fire, and the brakes liked to lock up, and the build quality was terrible. And that was a shame because those cars had such promise.
And didn't they, maybe cannibalize is the wrong word, but didn't they use some of the Citation-type parts on the Fiero?
Yes.
I was thinking that, yeah.
It was basically the Citation front end where the transverse engine was. And that engine was in the Citation. They basically turned it around and put it behind the...
Yeah, that's what I thought. It was a cost-saving thing, but I guess it worked.
It worked. And why not? I guess we used to call that parts bin engineering. All right. So you got three right?
I think I did.
See, you have won. And you're going to enjoy the bonus question.
Not a Fiero question, I assume?
No, it is a Fiero question.
Oh,
that's what makes this radical. It is about the subject of the day.
Wow.
The topic of the day.
That's the first time ever.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, are you ready?
Yep.
This is great. The members of what band can be seen sitting on a 1984 Fiero as part of the promotion for the Fiero launch?
You can stop. You don't even need to give me the multiple. I want to hear your multiple choice. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm bummed that you know this.
This is not necessary because I had that poster in my garage, and I think I still own it somewhere if I looked for it. But go on.
I have written maybe three articles over the last decade where I use that poster picture.
Really?
Because I love it so much.
It is cool, yeah.
All right. These are your choices if you needed them. Metallica, Hall & Oates, Blondie, REM.
Oh, man. I thought you were going to have some really crazy one like you would give Jill.
I was going to. I was going to say, like Gordon Lightfoot. Because he'll move the metal.
The answer is Hall & Oates.
Yes. Yes. Apparently, this was a bigger promotion than I knew it was. Because I don't remember it at the time. But looking back, it was part of their Big Bam Boom North American concert tour.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't remember that, but there is a poster of Hall and Oates, and I don't know which is which, sitting on the hood of a Fiero.
Hall is the blonde, Oates is the brunette. But
okay.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't even remember them as an 80s band, because in the 70s, this is a car story too. My cousins, Iggy and Rita, each one of them was given by their incredibly generous dad a Firebird when they graduated high school.
Wow.
Yeah, both were 350 automatics with AM FM. And nice. I remember the song, You're a Bitch Girl.
Oh, yeah.
And they would play that all the time. And it was just on the radio.
It's actually called Rich Girl, but...
Oh, is it?
Yes.
Is there a joke there?
The title is called Rich Girl.
Okay, it is.
Yes, but within the song, it says that.
Okay, I didn't know that. Now I have to check the dirty word thing.
I'm Mr. Music Trivia.
So there you have it. The Fiero, part of a big launch. General Motors does that too. They launch things in a big way and then forget about them.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is what happened to Saturn too. Man, that was crazy too. I remember Saturn. My sister bought a 1993 Saturn SL1, and it served her very well. It was green with a caramel interior. The interior looked cheap, but the color combination was fantastic. Mm-hmm. That car got 40 miles to the gallon.
Wow.
Was almost flawless. Dog slow. Oh my God. Going uphill was hell. Like, you'd be going up a hill and you would be downshifting. A thing you don't, we never, I got down to third once in a hill in Wisconsin. I don't remember why I was driving her car in Wisconsin. But then General Motors just ignored the brand. Started to sell non-plastic cars there. They started to negotiate prices because the whole deal was the one price thing. And that worked for a long time.
Yeah.
So that was kind of a shame, but that's what General Motors did. But the Fiero should have been something.
Yeah, I felt at the end of its run, they had fixed a lot of the things that I thought were deficiencies, the V6, and they had improved a lot of things about the car. And, I bought an 84, and by the time they got to the end of the run, I was kind of thinking I would maybe in a year or two buy another one, and they stopped.
Yeah, for the 88 model year, they did some serious revisions to the chassis.
Yeah.
So it rode a little bit better, and it handled as well as it should have. But it was mid-engine, so it was already kind of an interesting car to toss around.
Yep.
I never tossed one around because not my car. And then they stuffed the V6 in there, and that was burly.
Yeah.
And a relatively light car, so it should have been cooler.
That kind of annoyed me when they put the 6 in there, because it's like, why didn't they do that right off the bat? I mean,
I don't know. It might have taken some work to get that to fit.
That's true.
Because I think that was the heating, cooling, fire problem, was that... They had this very small place where they stuck an engine.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that's why there were internal failures. They were overheating.
That makes sense.
All right. Well, guess what we did?
We burned through a whole hour.
We did. And I thank you very much for filling in on the quiz. Your first quiz was a win.
Hey, do I get a trophy or what's a...
A donut.
A donut. That works.
I brought one donut today. It is yours, sir.
That's better than a trophy.
Yeah. I paid for that cash. I left change in the bucket.
Wow.
Yeah. That's the thing about charging stuff is that you never have singles for the tip. The tip.
Yeah.
Yeah. So today I had change. So that's good. All right. Thank you to Randy for filling in on the quiz. And thank you to Alex Shelton of Ford Philanthropy. And happy Memorial Day, everyone. We'll talk more about cars again next week.
Remember to check us out at consumerguide.com.
The Car Stuff Podcast is produced by J-Turn Media.
To advertise on the show, please drop us a line at carstuff@consumerguide.com.